Welcome to the College of Mythic Cartography podcast for May 15th, 2008, hosted by me, Willem Larson. In this podcast, I'd like to talk about rewilding adulthood. What does that mean? Well, for me, rewilding, though it has many other connotations, maybe a person running barefoot through the woods, or trapping animals, or building wilderness shelters. Yet, when we think of the word wild, and you think of, there's two common phrases that pop to my mind. Wild and free, and wild and crazy, right? Those are the main paired concepts that I think of when I think of the word wild. And really, what does it mean for someone to act crazy? It essentially refers to a kind of unpredictable and very self-willed behavior. Someone at rewild.info, or the forum I moderate, recently mentioned that wild may come from the root of willed, as in self-willed. This may or may not be a true etymology or an accurate etymology, but it certainly matches up with my sense of the word wild, right? Even wilderness, you know, land that actualizes itself, that is, has its own will, that that hasn't been domesticated, right? So wild, free, unpredictable. When you think of a wolf's behavior, wild animals are very, very predictable in their own way. I mean, if you think about it, a wild animal is very clear about their needs. It's us as domesticated and civilized peoples who aren't clear about our needs. When we go to feed a deer, when we go to court a wild animal to establish a relationship, when we interact with bears and all kinds of wild beings, it's us that are transmitting unnoticed emotions, vibes, body language, thoughts. We're like a hyper tense and unpredictable ball of repressions and denials and tensions and fears. And when we go innocently go up to an animal and we want to reconnect in that relationship, we want to invite the bird to feed off our hand. We want to swim in a wild river. All these beings, these rivers, these landscapes, these animals stay true to their nature and reflect us right back, super accurately. And when they jump away or snarl or act in fear, they act with full embodiment of who they are. But we're the ones who are part curious, naively innocent of our own possessiveness of this possible relationship. We do this to our domesticated friends. We disown our own feelings constantly. Why do you make me feel this way? I blame you for such and such. And certainly, as I've mentioned before on other podcasts, it's that master-slave relationship that we're familiar with. We are a modern global human culture of slaves and masters. And even the person at the tippy top is our president or our CEOs are still thinking about how their parents abused them and blaming them on some level and blaming other people for their own continuing behavior. I would not call this adult behavior. In our culture, Since I was a child, my father used to tell me that most adults don't feel like adults, that they're going around putting on a show of adulthood, but they feel still like they're children inside, that they're teenagers, that they've never, no one ever told them when they crossed that line. And they're waiting, they're still waiting. And maybe they make it to their deathbed, still waiting. Nobody ever told me. There's that phrase, what will I be when I grow up? As if you could ever finish growing up, you know? And there's that E prime trap in there. And in any case, what will I be when I grow up? Well, what do you do? What do you do as you continue to grow? Really phrases the question central to rewilding. How do you rewild? So to rewild adulthood means to reconnect with your own will, your own needs, your own feelings. It means to free yourself and become your own authority, your own expert on what makes you a whole person. Nobody else can do this for you. In fact, you are an expert on yourself. No one has more experience, not even the most insightful and observant tracker. Nobody has more experience than you about you. So really, it always lays in your hands, the responsibility and the power to choose your own adulthood. And another issue of rewilding that comes up a lot is a sense of shame that we don't fit in to this modern culture as a, you know, adults, biological adults, even probably as children. There's this ongoing sense of guilt and shame that we don't have conventional signs of success, money or cars or property or awards or titles or labels. And there's those ideas of someday I'll be such and such, I'll be a writer, I'll be an artist, I'll be a manager, I'll be in charge, I'll be paid more, promoted. So to rewild adulthood really means to abandon all of that and to say, I choose my own life. No adult escapes having to make it up as they go along. No adult gets away with having an answer. Nobody. Nobody in our culture, not the wisest guru, not the most profound sage, has stopped making it up as they go along. Every single last one of us, diplomats, teachers, professors, senators, experts and authorities of any persuasion, all of them are making their best guess at the world. And the sooner we all accept this and surrender to it, really, because it's on a certain level, as domesticated beings, this is quite an upsetting notion. If everybody is making it up as they go along, if the mayor of my city, if the police officer, if the doctor performing surgery on me is making it up, is making his best guess as to what to do, what are the implications of such a thing? Well, the implications are nobody gets away with a final answer. Much like no matter what any particular scientist says, if you investigate the fundamental underpinnings of science as a modern endeavor, you'll find that no certain knowledge exists. And that scientific knowledge itself doesn't belong to a higher plane of knowledge. No. Science is a social endeavor. It's a social experience. It's science means we look over each other's shoulders. Really, because nothing, you know, as trackers, we've been doing double blind studies. We've been making inductions and observations. We've been reducing variables in our experiments, and so we can just control one thing and observe that. As much as we associate that, those kind of behaviors with the modern worldview, actually, in a very respectful and honoring way, we've been observing as honestly as we can for as long as we've been humans. So science is just yet another opportunity to obscure the fact that knowledge is really as uncertain as anything else. And you'll see scientists having to start over from scratch many times in different fields when one thing just stops making sense. Just new evidence appears that undermines everything. And so this is so important. This is so really, really important to realize that no outside authority or expert is available to make our decisions for us and to make our observations for us. And that if we want to have the kind of impact and influence on our own lives comparable to the really powerful impact of science, which is science as a culture that I don't agree with, that of the common paradigm of reductivism. We can understand things by breaking them into their component parts or cutting them smaller and smaller, that sort of mechanistic worldview that has yet to give way and really characterizes all science that I observe. But besides that, one thing that you have to admit is that science as a social experience is very powerful. It has a lot of impact on our lives, and lots of fascinating things come out of it. And it's that revolution of I make something, and then you look at it, and it gives you an idea, and so you make something, and then I see what you've made, and then both of us. This is classic. This is why you never track alone as a tracker. You always bring other trackers with you because you're always learning. And when you're alone, you're always right. And when other people come with you, suddenly the world seems a lot more fluid. You're hearing things that you didn't even imagine you would see in that track or in the world. You're getting other perspectives. That's a big part of human beings' jobs as social beings, is to back each other up. Look at each other's blind spots. So, in other articles at the College of Mythic Cartography in the archive, you'll find a series of articles on breaking the spell, rewilding your ability to reason, the village philosopher. There's six articles I think in a row that all hit on these points. And I recommend you go back and read them. There's some supporting materials and books that I've referenced, if that does anything for you. But otherwise, I've continued to think about this. And as rewilding adults, firstly, we acknowledge, in my opinion, that the rewilding never stops. If I ever say I'm a rewilded adult, I've certainly made an error. I've misspoken. And I'm very conscious that I see no end to my rewilding. I can't imagine that I'll ever stop making it up as I go along, just like everyone else. I can't finish. I don't even know that death will finish this process. So as a rewilding adult, I have to take a stand. I have to look at what makes me embarrassed or ashamed in terms of how this culture sees me, or how I judge myself being internally colonized by this culture. And in the process of decolonization and undomesticating, in other words, rewilding, in rewilding myself, I say, I choose what's shameful. I choose what's shameful. And I no longer believe that to be a being with needs and feelings is shameful. I believe that to deny those needs and feelings, to take pride in one's absolute rugged self-sufficiency, I call that shameful. And I call that self-denying. And I call that life-denying. As a rewilding adult, I make these observations and I make these conclusions. And I allow for somebody else to contradict me or have another insight that I'll listen to. But at this point in my life, I no longer feel ashamed to not achieve success according to this culture's, this modern culture's perceptions of what makes someone successful. No more. And that points back to that grave of right and wrong in any case. I think, in a sense, if we were to pick apart what shame means, why even use the word shame, guilt? Do these words even help us at all as rewilding adults? Do they have any purpose? Well, I'm very conscious that tribal peoples make great use of social pressure and social consequences to behavior. And that's really what we're talking about. If shame and guilt have any role as rewilded concepts, if we can rewild shame and guilt, what would they look like? Would they bear any resemblance to modern notions of shame and guilt? I have a lot of trepidation in even bringing this up, because casting off domestication is fraught with self-recrimination, with self-judgment, with suddenly now we're rewilding, we get back in that trap of am I being a virtuous rewilder? Am I rewilding the right way? Am I rewilding hard enough or thoroughly enough? Am I being a hypocrite? I mean, that's civilization all over again. Those are all judgments of civilization. Much like in the Indian and Native American community, the whole notion of the blood quantum, you know, what percentage Native are you, was an idea pioneered by our government, by the U.S. government, to categorize Native Americans and make them more easy to deal with in the bureaucracy. Right? It's much like this culture wants to do with everything else. If, in order for it to stick you behind the meat case, so that then you can be consumed by members of this culture, they need to figure out what your price per pound is. They need to figure out what quality meat you are, you know, grade A, grade B. They have to categorize you. If you look into Native traditions of adoption, you'll see that blood quantum has never had anything to do with nativeness until recently. Now, certainly, I won't make light of issues of cultural appropriation, of white people claiming, for example, like the authority of a Lakota heritage because they've studied with a Lakota medicine man, or writing books and about Native American spirituality and never mentioning that they themselves come from Germany or England, or in terms of ancestry, the commercialization of Native cultures is rampant. And I definitely don't want to pass that over. I'm very conscious of that. And it informs a lot of work I do. And the U.S. government invented the blood quantum, right? It invented that measurement. And that's something to think about, if nothing else. It's really something to think about. So when we look at these kinds of issues, when we look at like how this culture wants to measure us, what I realize personally is that I have to come up with my own measures for my life. And as I continue to stay more and more aware of my own needs and feelings, as I deepen that relationship, moment to moment, quite literally, with what I feel and what that flags about what I need, it allows me to cast off abstractions that don't serve me as well. So when I mentioned earlier about us taking great care or me personally taking great care in rewilding the sense of shame and the sense of guilt, I would define shame as an extra feeling about a feeling, and also guilt, right? Feelings about feelings. So for example, when I feel angry, and then if I have a moment where I think to be angry, to feel anger is not very peacemaking or is not very mature or anything like that, then I'll have a feeling about that. I've made a judgment about this feeling, and then I feel sad and ashamed. And literally, I contract up like a spider and hope nobody sees me because of a feeling I had. I've had many experiences over my life that I call dark spirals. My friend Urban Scout, many years ago, really for a while talked about how he had begun to see the wheel, the what I call the wise compass, the four directions and the circle of life. He could see it as something that further and further affirmed life as you traveled around in one direction. Or you could travel around that wheel and experience all the dark aspects of each direction. So instead of peace, love, joy, and purpose as you travel around that wheel, maybe instead you feel shame, self-doubt, failure, and self-denial. As you have feelings about your feelings, as you feel sad and then feel anger at your sadness, as you feel happy and then feel embarrassed about your happiness. I mean, who hasn't had these experiences? You know, someone tells a joke at a funeral and you start laughing and suddenly you feel like you shouldn't have laughed, or there's just so many cases where we as domesticated beings are trained to not have the wrong feeling. And if we have the wrong feeling, we exact self-judgment and self-punishment right away. In fact, I would say, I'm sure the vast majority of the inmates in prisons are doing an excellent job on destroying themselves emotionally. Perhaps there are cases where if they were set free, they would do physical damage to people, but I absolutely trust that the majority of them are wounding themselves far more than a state authority could ever wish. So this is really dangerous to have these feelings about feelings, right? And knowing that a tribal cultures work according to social pressure. And the closer you can stay to simply accepting the fact that if you hurt a friend's feeling, it simply makes you sad. It simply makes you sad. I would call that a rewilded sense of shame. You don't judge the fact that something you said your friend heard and then felt hurt by. It wounded them. You don't feel, you don't call it wrong, but you simply feel sad. Now, I've seen so many times somebody say something and their listener react poorly to it and feel hurt or and maybe even start to cry. And then the speaker then would become angry. Would become angry at the reaction, right? Nobody, I assume good, I mean, positive intentions, and I assume no one would fake crying. It's a natural reaction. So why would a person ever feel angry at someone crying? Well, it's because it's kind of embarrassing that I might have said something thoughtless. That literally, I didn't think about the impact of it. And this, to cover that up, because I'm so worried about blame and right and wrong, I'll simply attack and become angry that that person had a feeling response, cried, you know? And that'll just, that'll protect me. But what do we need to protect? I said something, the other person reacted by crying. And now I feel sad too, and that's the reality. I feel really sad, and I didn't want to make them cry. There's such a high-stakes feeling in our culture about these kinds of issues, where if you get into an argument, if somebody in the room starts crying, if anybody has any real feelings, uh-oh, anything could happen. It's crazy. It's wild, isn't it? Well, I would say that those feelings are wild. Those feelings are rewilding. That embodies rewilding. Honestly letting your feelings flow and then turn off when they need to turn off and staying with them as long as they continue and not hiding them or denying them or trying to be more convenient for other people who may not want to hear someone cry. You know, not trying to make other people's life easier because, you wouldn't want to burden them with your grief. That's madness. And to me, that characterizes domesticated thinking. I see that when I see people who are essentially afraid of punishment and what their masters will say to their slaves for acting incorrectly or inappropriately. Right, that old thing that we get from schooling, the idea of inappropriate behavior. Well, So when you feel ashamed about anything, when you have a feeling, what I do is when I'm at my best, I stick with it and I look at it and I don't turn away and I stay with it until I finish it, until it's done. I don't try and stop it early. I don't try and stuff it in a can. This is all assuming that I'm, not doing anything dangerous or at the time or something that requires great focus so that I don't get injured. But if I have a stable, safe space, I stick with it, right? And that brings up another issue. To do this is not virtuous behavior. To do this is a gift to yourself as a rewilding adult. So you do save it for safe spaces, and you do save it for friendships with people who care about you. And for people who don't care about you, they don't get to experience this side of you until they've earned it. We don't just give this to anybody. Another aspect to our culture is that we've obliterated our in-group and out-group line so that everybody in our culture is simultaneously a member of our in-group and a member of our out-group. You know, and so you get things like being nice to everybody and helping strangers out and giving, you know. And on a certain level, this is okay. But on another level, it means that we've totally ignored all our boundaries to what are relationships that actually nourish us. And, you know, do we actually feel safe relating to certain people? And I'd encourage you as a rewilding adult to start making those decisions. Who, by relating to them, do you actually feel support come back? Who gives you energy back? Those people, treasure them and continue to invest in them. And even if your family feels messed up and torn apart, on a certain level, that's the work that lies before us as rewilding adults. Who else to start with in rebuilding our lives and rebuilding our ability to not judge than with the people who are most intimate, most close, and have known us the longest? Our families. My mentor in a lot of these issues of peacemaking and cultural change, one of my mentors, Jake Swamp, a former sub-chief of the Wolf Clan of the Mohawk Nation, and now retired from that work and doing a lot of marriage counseling at Akwesasne in upstate New York, he always tells me that start first in your own living room. All of us want to run out into the community plaza and start collaborating, and yes, and this is where the peace work needs to be done. And he says, start with yourself and then turn to your family and work with them next. And then extended family and friends. And then maybe you're willing to work with the rest of the village. But if you want to talk about peace, and you want to talk about having a good message, well, and your home is chaos or off balance, yeah, it's going to be mostly talk, isn't it? It doesn't have a very strong foundation. So, as we rewild adulthood, we choose to be our own authority. We choose that instead of shame, that we rewild shame and allow ourselves to simply have feelings. Rather than having feelings about feelings, we strip it down and we just stick with the feeling. I feel sad that you feel sad. I feel embarrassed that you feel angry. I feel happy that you feel comfortable and satisfied and well-fed. These are just very simple things. And once we start having feelings about feelings, boy, all kinds of stuff can get pretty nutty. Now, there's a time and a place for feelings about feelings. And that's a little farther along the line, and it's getting into that world starts to get into the world of really a deep how our emotions work and what drives us as beings. But I want to stick with just keeping things simple and not messing with powerful stuff like that. Certainly, supernormal human feats all have to do with knowing this so well that you can drive one feeling with another, and have pretty amazing experiences. But that would be getting on a tangent, and that's for me. That's the world of what people might call spiritual, but I'm not a big fan of that word. But definitely, really. It's where adventure awaits. But for now, the real, really deep primary adventure is this scary world, this taboo world of needs and feelings. And for most people, if I say, yeah, have you ever thought about your needs and feelings? Let's talk about our needs and feelings. I sound like a flaky hippie, right? That stereotype of a flaky hippie, right? The one who's fluffy and, you know, has no boundaries and wants to stare at their navel. You know, that stereotype may or may not exist, but that's besides the point, because I have personally experienced that relating honestly, staying aware and accepting what's going on inside me, feelings and needs, can be some of the most terrifying of ordeals and experiences. It is not fluffy bunny stuff. It is testing and challenging. And other mentors of mine have mentioned that the work we do as we pass through adulthood, and someday maybe other people will call us elders because of all the work we've done on ourselves, that that this work, in order to get to a place where we can be so helpful to people that they will want to use that label on us, elder, which I think that's an important to make point to make, is that an elder is not a self-appointed position. it's only something that I believe you're only ever an elder as much as you mirror other people's nourishment back to them. The fact that they feel more supported and more helped out and more whole after speaking with you, well, you can call that what you want. Many people call that eldering. But how that has happened, though, is because you no longer, when they come to you, you don't go, well, I'm the judgments that need to happen here are this and that and this and that. From what I see, that happens because you've pulled at the strings of your heart, at the tangled knots in your chest. You've pulled and unknotted and untangled that mess of judgments and shame and regret and guilt until clean strings of feelings lead back to those memories, until just sadness goes back to this memory and just bittersweetness goes back to this one. And simple joy goes back to this one without shame. That's what it means to rewild as an adult to me. To reach such a point of clarity where when someone approaches you, you can really reflect them. That you no longer need affirmation from someone else because you've done the work. once again, not because of your virtue, but because you've really done the work. You've sorted yourself out. And the natural consequences of sorting yourself out means you then finally can hear other people. As someone who teaches tracking at times, one of my tracking mentors, John Young, told me about a metaphor for thinking about one's impact on nature. As you're walking through the woods or through any place full of life, really anywhere, but let's just say a patch of woods, and you're observing the life there, you have a zone of disturbance, that is the zone at which you impact that world, and you have a zone of awareness, that is how far your awareness reaches out and can observe other things impacting the world. And you can think of those as two circles, one closer in and one farther out. Now, in the beginning, we start out with our zone of disturbance way out. Wild animals and the life in these green spaces we go to see us long before we see them. And because our zone of awareness is closer in than that zone of disturbance, all we see is our own impact. My favorite way of thinking about this is when you look in a mirror, what do you see? You see yourself. You see yourself reflected back. That is exactly what is happening most of the time in most of our relationships. We are simply seeing ourselves reflected back. This is a natural consequence of having work to do to sort out our own needs and feelings. There's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing wrong with it at all. And we allow for it. We allow for it by with tools like E-Primitive, never making absolutist qualifications about things, never coming up to concrete conclusions that can't be shaken about other people or how the world works, because we're constantly making our best guesses and just about our own reflection that we're seeing. Now, something magical happens. As we become more and more clear, for some of us, we start talking less. For others, we move more quietly through the world. Why? Well, as we become more and more clear, our zone of awareness starts moving out because we're spending less time in our own head. We're more clear. There's less static. And as our zone of awareness moves out, we start noticing our own disturbance as something we've created. And we start to move slower and slower and maybe talk less. There's no one way that zone of disturbance shrinks. For each person, I think it's different. But suffice to say, it does start shrinking. And at some point, that zone of disturbance passes inward. Within that line of that zone of awareness, that outward expanding circle, and whammo, suddenly, we see the world clearer than we have ever seen it before. For the first time, we actually see other beings' impact instead of solely our own. To take the mirror thing even farther, it's much like Alice in the Looking Glass. If you go back to the illustrations of Alice in that Looking Glass, you'll notice that as long as that mirror over the mantelpiece reflected her, there was no world to explore. There was just the humdrum everyday world of Alice. The reason she chose to move through the looking glass is because she no longer saw her own reflection. The mirror no longer reflected her. In fact, it became more like a window, and she saw through it. And that's why she could go on an adventure. That's how she could cross into an entirely new world. Think about this. This is how important that work is. This is how important it is. As long as the static and the screen of our own unaccepted, unnoticed needs and feelings, repressed, denied, shameful, embarrassing, as long as they form a screen against us, seeing the world, we no longer see. We just simply don't see other people as fresh and real beings. It's only once we cast off, well, and have worked through a certain amount of issues, that we begin to get glimpses of this other world. And this is the project of a lifetime, isn't it? Once again, this brings us back to why we call ourselves rewilding adults, perhaps, and not rewilded adults. How could you ever finish this kind of work? There's always more to see, and there's always another layer to get rid of one's own impact on the world. So, once we've also achieved a certain level of this, think about this. If you turn to the person next to you and you feel fully confident that they will not for a moment deny their own needs and feelings, well, let's not be too strict about this. You look at them and you know that they have a certain capacity to stay aware and honest and true to their own needs and feelings. That's all we're asking for. It's not an absolutist thing. And that ability, that capacity, is in somewhat rapport with your own. There's a sense of peerage. You both can stay aware and true and communicate about your needs and feelings as much as necessary. Say yes when you actually can say yes, and say no when it's important that you say no to requests and to what you need, and boundaries that you have to maintain. When you work with other adults who have this ability, suddenly what they say you can actually trust and rely on. You realize what that means? I mean, it's really, it's quite an amazing thought. It's quite an amazing thought, because as I've written recently in an article on the College of Mythic Cartography blog, two people that trust each other and can rely on each other and act in that kind of accord, right, that have truly become a kind of in-group, and when necessary have one mind in action, because they know, just like in the tradition of attachment parenting, they know their needs will be met, right? Those two people are worth far more than just the sum of one person and one person put together. I mean, this is, think about it, when you think of heroic stories, buddy movies, right? Action movies or hero stories of all the hero and the sidekick and all the there's a wealth, a universe of culture and tradition about how much two people can accomplish in the world when they are bam, when they know each other and can rely on each other. You have people come back from war or from really trying adventures with a friend for life, and the profound nourishment that friendship gives them, how it saved their lives, and how it has changed them forever. I mean, there it is, right? That's what That's what a connection of that kind, an ability to trust another adult of that kind, that's what it can do. Well, what if you have 10 adults like that? 10 adults who can come to that kind of one-mindedness? That's when the magic happens. That's when you see the power and the unity as embodied in the Iroquois Confederacy, the Haudenosaunee, people of the Longhouse, who actually are responsible for America, for better or for worse, even forming, you know, and responsible for the document of the Constitution, which is an imperfect copy of their system. The two houses, the separation of branches, all that, that's all comes from the Iroquois tradition. And in fact, the Iroquois, the Haudenosaunee, have a great law of peace that is really three elements. I mean, well, their great law of peace is actually a long oral document that's been written many times, but the translations suffer very much by being written down, definitely. And the spirit of the great law of peace, though, the central spirit is, like I mentioned, three things. Garwiyo, which is the good message. Sgana, which you can translate as peace. And Gashatonsara, which means power or unity. Now, I'm mangling Mohawk a little bit, as best as I tried to learn it off of, learn the language. My friend Jake Swamp was definitely humoring me when I tried to speak it and correcting me a bunch. So as best pronounced as I can, all those are three Mohawk words, I said. And all three of those words are of course, imperfectly translated, because Gashatonsara doesn't mean power as in, you know, ability, you know, power over. It's more more of that sense of power with. You know, the author of The Chalice and the Blade, I forget her name, made this distinction that there's power over and there's power with. And I think that's a good way of characterizing this word. Gashatonsara means unity and power at the same time. And that's the ability of adults, rewilding adults, to act together. You know, to come together in consensus and how did they do that? Well, because Garwiyo, the good message, and Sgana, peace, they can speak about what they need and their feelings, and this ability to speak with clarity about this has given them Sgana, peace. It's given them self-clarity. Them understanding your own needs is the source of peace. Peace is not the absence of conflict. And the Mohawk make this point too. Peace, Sgana and peace for in their culture does not mean we are not at war. It is not the opposite of warfare. It is how we deal with conflict. That's what it is. So, what does that mean? What else does that mean? But when I feel sad and you feel angry, how we deal with that? And if how we deal with that is staying true to our feelings, understanding, not having feelings about feelings, staying clear that I'm simply responding to you, it's a natural reflection, there's no shame or guilt feeling it as long as you feel it, letting it go when it's time to let it go, communicating with trust, me knowing that whatever you need, you'll ask me. Or if I ask you, you'll respond honestly about what you need. I mean, this is the work. So this has been a really long episode, it's probably time to wrap it up. There's a lot to cover, and there's really so much more to talk about. So many beautiful things really close to my heart that I've touched on during this podcast. And I include some links with the podcast notes that I would really encourage you to look at. And I'm happy to answer questions about this. And I wish you good luck with all these things. Because even as I sit here and I talk about this, I mean, of course, if you remember, I'm making this up as I go along. As a member of a nascent culture, a new rewilding culture that is forming one adult at a time, right? And as I look to my friends, they teach me about myself. At the very least, when I look at them, I can see a reflection of myself and maybe see myself a little more clearly. They do me that much favor. And someday I hope to actually see them for themselves rather than just a reflection. And that happens sometimes in glimpses, I think. But this is the work, isn't it? You've just listened to the College of Mythic Cartography podcast for May 15th, 2008, hosted by me, Willem Larson. Thanks for listening.